Audio on the classic UFO book, From Outer Space to You, by Howard Menger. This is audio of parts of the classic UFO book, From Outer Space to You, from 1959, by Howard Menger. He was born February 17, 1922, dead February 25, 2009. Partly edited by Lucas Luiz 2017. But remark that he, Lucas, does not fully seem to understand multidimensionality. That the so-called physical plane that we are primarily on now, has two levels, the gross physical, that most people know, as well as the finer, form-creating level, also called the etheric. And it is on this fine physical level that the aliens operate from and live on, so to speak, but they can, in terms of consciousness and technology, also descend and visit our gross physical level. So all space contacts, including those of Omniconic, comes primarily from this fine physical level, which is also called the fifth dimension in many of today's New Age books. Rune remark. From Outer Space to You, Howard Menger. The Last of Atlantis. The Atlantean stood in the blazoned night within the disk so burnished bright, poised to launch him into unknown space at speeds unknown in this earthly pace. This man was the best the race could find, sound of body and sound of mind, the highest evolved of all their men to command this ship and the crew of 10. It was he who de-race at the speed of light, the first to see the galactic might of star islands only known by few and not yet seen in earthly view. A thousands years they de said he de be streaking through the galactic sea to a target 500 light years hence in a state of time held in suspense. With a mighty surge the disk took flight upward, upward into endless night, lost soon in the starry heavens black as this man cast one long glance back. Years to decades to centuries became man learned to hurt, to kill, and maim, slipping backward from the heights attained as the light of love grew dim and waned. As the earth returned to a barbaric age, a new life cycle turned its page. The earth's crust split and spewed up flame, and the boiling sea scaled Atlantis' shame. 10 centuries passed and the ship returned to an earth now degenerate and burned, not fit to sustain the life of few who de-lived the Creator's love and knew. They hovered for months about our earth, vainly seeking a new hope's birth, saw naught but ego, hate and pain, man against man for paltry gain. With heavy heart and saddened eye, this man of space soon cast the die, turned the ship outward to endless space to find a home to sustain his race. In the spiraling stardust lies a far-off land where even now they lend a hand to raise us from our knees to see the errors that cast them beneath the sea. Dedicated to all humanity on planet Earth. It was in Grantwood, New Jersey, that I met my first love. I was born in Brooklyn, N.Y. February 17, 1922, but when I was a year old mother and dad moved to Grantwood where we lived for several years. The object of my affection was a classmate, a fluffy, feminine, blonde, blue-eyed bit of pulchritude, who completely stole my young heart. But my parents were quite amused when I announced that I intended to marry my 6-year-old sweetheart. The romance was short-lived and I broken-hearted when we moved to a country property in High Bridge, NJ. My brother, Alton, was 4 at the time, and I was 8. I could not quite forgive my parents for taking me away from my love, until I saw the beautiful rolling hills and fields of northern New Jersey. The newness and excitement of the country slowly supplanted the hurt memories of the girl I left behind. We children were delighted with our new home in the country. The fields were covered with daisies when we first saw the farm. To the rear of the house were fruit trees and woods and brooks which made a veritable paradise for 2 young energetic boys. Dad and mother worked hard to fix up the small, modest bungalow. Meanwhile my brother and I enjoyed long treks into the woods and fields. We played explorers, and exciting were our safaris into the jungles of the nearby woods, all fraught with imaginary and delightful dangers. During the summer we had many playmates. Next door was a summer boarding house which accommodated many families during the summer season, and there we always found willing companions among the visiting children. The winter I remember most as fields of white and steely blue shadows at about dark when reluctantly we would have to go inside, leaving behind our sleds, our games of fox and goose in the snow, and, rarely, skating when the nearby pond would freeze over. Somehow I remember those winters on the farm with a sadness and a gnawing, lump-throated longing, akin to the feeling when, as a child, I would, in quiet moments, even then begin thinking, that all of these wonderful moments could not last. That soon, far too soon, I would be a man, and even then I knew that once full grown, such moments and such mysteriously ecstatic feelings could never be re-experienced. But I suppose we loved the summer best, when the woods and country living opened a whole new world to us. It was in this pastoral setting, in the warm, lavish extravagance of June and July that I began to experience other feelings I was at a loss to explain. I began to have flashbacks, or hazy remembrances of scenes, places and happenings which somehow were familiar to me, but were outside my real experiences. They seemed to be of another world. About this time we began to see the discs in the sky. We watched them skim across the heavens, hover, and sometimes disappear. My playmates did not always see them, but I seemed to sense just when to look up. Alton saw them too, and when we told our parents they only smiled patronizingly as if in quiet agreement of what they felt were youthful flights of fancy. Dad, a handsome blonde-headed man with patrician features, was an adamant Catholic, while Mother, with enough red in her auburn hair to ensure a fiery disapproval of certain of his beliefs, was an unyielding Methodist, and sometimes the difference in interpretation of religious concepts would lead to most voluble discussions. While their discussions never led to disharmony, I was caught between my loyalty to both of them and was often deeply disturbed because I did not know which to believe entirely. Religion was the only matter about which Dad and Mum could never agree, and I remember that when their talking of it led to near arguments, I would go off to myself and sometimes cry. But in confusion of trying to analyze, in my young way, these conflicting beliefs, I learned to think for myself and form my own concepts of God. That I believe I owe to my mother, for in spite of the difference of religious views to which I was exposed, she managed to firmly establish in my mind and heart the omnipresence of an infinite creator. My brother and I continued seeing the bright, shining circular objects in the sky, and one day one of them landed in the field where we were playing. It was a disc-shaped object about 10 feet in diameter. Afraid, but fascinated and curious, we walked toward it to get a better view. As we neared it, we noticed another bright object, a much larger one of similar design, hovering in the sky above the smaller craft, as if observing it and us. Our hearts palpitated, but curiosity overwhelmed our fright as we proceeded cautiously. When we were about 25 feet from the object, the larger airborne craft disappeared, and while we were trying to muster enough courage to go closer, the disc on the ground began vibrating, then took off at a terrific rate of speed in a blinding flash of light. This experience we again enthusiastically recounted, but again our story was assigned to the realm of childish imagination. I believe that Mother sensed, however, my gift of sensitive perception, for now and then when I mentioned such things to her I could tell that behind her pretended disbelief was a knowing look of understanding. Gradually feeling a need to be alone, I began going off by myself, deep into the woods. There I had the feeling that somehow I could find the answer to the odd half-memories I experienced. Some very strong impulse always drew me into one certain area of the woods. True, it was a beautiful section of the forest, idyllic in the summer, with a brook and almost tropical plants and foliage, but I knew in my heart that something else beside the natural beauty took me there. A feeling of peace permeated the place, though interrupted at times by chattering and busy squirrels, running up and down trees in noisy pursuits. I remember timid and inquisitive rabbits, a deer which occasionally would come up very close. The soft-eyed gentle animal seemed to trust me and consider me one of the usual inhabitants of the forest. To this enchanted spot I came at every opportunity I could find. But one day in 1932, when I was 10, I saw something even more beautiful than the surroundings. There, sitting on a rock by the brook, was the most exquisite woman my young eyes had ever beheld. The warm sunlight caught the highlights of her long golden hair as it cascaded around her face and shoulders. The curves of her lovely body were delicately contoured, revealed through the translucent material of clothing which reminded me of the habit of skiers. I halted in my tracks, and for a moment my breath stopped. I was not frightened, but an overwhelming wonderment froze me to the spot. She turned her head in my direction. Even though very young, the feeling I received was unmistakable. It was a tremendous surge of warmth, love and physical attraction which emanated from her to me. Suddenly all my anxiety was gone and I approached her as one would an old friend or loved one. She seemed to radiate and glow as she sat on the rock, and I wondered if it were due to the unusual quality of the material she wore, which had a shimmering, shiny texture not unlike but far surpassing the sheen of nylon. The clothing had no buttons, fasteners or seams I could discern. She wore no makeup, which would have been unnecessary to the fragile transparency of her camellia-like skin with pinkish undertones. Her eyes, opalescent discs of gold, turned their smiling affection on me with a tranquil luminescence. "Howard," she spoke my name, and I trembled with joy. "I have come a long way," and she paused smilingly, "to see you, Howard, and to talk with you." I shall always remember those first words exactly as she spoke them, but then my thoughts swirled in a maelstrom of emotion and slowly coalescing understanding as she continued to talk. I remember that nobody had ever spoken to me as she did. She talked with me as if I were much older. She said she knew where I had come from and what my purpose would be here on Earth. She and her people had observed me for a long time and in ways I would not quickly understand. When she spoke of her people, I still could not understand they were from another planet. As I listened in awe, my eyes delighted in feasting on the beauty of this lovely creature. Every movement of her body, as she stood up and walked toward me and reached out her hands to me, was a symphony of rhythm, grace and beauty. I seemed to be encompassed by the very glow, almost visible, that emanated from her presence. Somehow the entire area surrounding us appeared to take on a greater kind of radiance. I have often tried to describe it as like seeing a Technicolor movie in three dimensions and being a part of the action in the film. Again she pronounced my name and reassured me she knew who I was, from a long, long time. And then some words that have taken on even more joy and meaning as I have grown older, "We are contacting our own." She told me that even though I did not understand many of the things she told me then, later in life I would. Her words would be impressed on my mind, I suppose she said subconscious, but it was difficult, as she said again, to make me understand. I remember that she compared the idea to that of a phonograph, which would be played back to me time and again. "It is no fault of yours, Howard, that you cannot understand everything. Do not worry." And she laughed musically. She continued to speak to me as if I were an adult. I cannot remember many of her exact phrasings, but the phonograph has played back the ideas, each replay taking on more and more meaning. Some of the actual words were beyond me, for they were words that meant nothing to a 10-year-old, frequency, vibration, evolvement. She smiled most of the time as she spoke, and now and then she laughed as she answered questions before I could ask them. She seemed to know all of my thoughts. But then a look of sadness came over the beautiful face, and tears came to my eyes as for the first time I pitied my new wonderful friend. She spoke of a great change to take place in this country as well as the world. Wasteful wars, torture and destruction would be brought on by the misunderstandings of people. "As you grow older," she said, "you will grow to know your purpose. You will help other people grow to know their purpose too. This would depend on evolvement and universal laws, and I would be drawn to other people who have missions akin to mine. Then she stood up and I knew she was about to say goodbye. I noticed she was about my mother's height, slender, lithe, with no exaggeration of voluptuous curves. She extended her hand and grasped mine. It was warm and soft and I was reluctant to let it go. I began to cry. "Don't worry, Howard," she promised. "You may see me again. But it will be many years before you do. And I am not nearly so wise nor wonderful as others of my people who will often visit with you." "Where do they live?" I asked perplexedly and almost petulantly. "Ah, far away, but you will find them. They will come to you. You will know where to go and meet them. And if your mind is troubled, remember, they will always be around, watching out for you, guiding you." Again she laughed and I could not help be affected with her happy humor. I laughed, too, though with tears drying on my face. She said I should leave first, then she would go. "May I look back?" "Oh yes, Howard, you may look back." And I did, after walking slowly away. She was still sitting on the rock, smiling, and she waved. I turned and ran, sobbing, first hardly audibly, then louder and louder, till my wails of a happy kind of sadness grew and filled the forest. 2. The man in khaki. I often went back to the brook in the woods, hoping to see her. The place looked the same, though lacking the radiance which seemed to illuminate it that one day. The brook still ran musically beside the rock, the foliage was still lush, and the squirrels kept up their chatter, but the lady was not there. But in time it seemed that the enchantment of the place had gradually faded. Perhaps I was growing up. Perhaps I had never seen her and only imagined it. I wondered about it often as I lay awake nights, remembering. I decided that even if the beautiful girl were not real, the things she had told me were taking on more and more reality. I remembered she said I would undergo many trials. That I would be unhappy. Partly due to the many mistakes I would make, natural things, due to miseducation, or the pangs incurred in a gaining of education. The experience with the golden-haired naiad of the forest had a profound and lasting effect on my life. Throughout my life the things I had learned in the forest were to lead to conflict with the conventional ideas of the world. It began with a difficult time in school. A great deal of the information my teachers tried to convey to me was, I knew, untrue. The girl on the rock had told me of life and people on the other planets, yet in school we were taught that the planets in our solar system were lifeless worlds, either too hot or too cold, or covered by poisonous gases. Nevertheless, I soon learned it was often better to put down the accepted answers even though I knew they were wrong. One had to live with other people and their ideas. But sometimes I rebelled, and as a result many of my classmates and teachers grew to think I was odd. My intellectual rebellion had a bad effect on my school grades. I remember that once we were assigned to write a theme for an English class, and I chose the subject, The Evolution and Evolvement of Man, in which I developed how man had ascended from the very life cell, which in itself possesses a consciousness and a portion of the infinite creator, to the time when he first stood erect on two legs. My teacher marked an F on my paper because my views conflicted with his religious ideas. As in other classes, I noticed I was becoming unpopular. So I became quiet and retiring, keeping my ideas to myself. I finished 4 years of high school despite my frustration of being unable to express what I knew to be true. Shortly after leaving high school in 1941, I worked at an arsenal in North Jersey for more than a year. Then I entered the army. This was 1942. They sent me to a tank outfit in the Southwest. For a while the harsh and new environs of army life took my mind from the many things which had occupied it while growing up. We were on maneuvers from Texas to Louisiana for 18 months. After arriving there, somehow the girl on the rock and the ideas she had expressed, particularly of the brotherhood of man, grew to be like a dream, as the terrible realities of war pushed her from my thoughts. But, then, in one of the most desolate places I have ever been, a firing range outside El Paso, another strange thing happened that once again brought my earlier experiences into vivid focus. We were camped in the desert, not far from the Rio Grande River. The naked, stark sterility of the immense scene nevertheless had a kind of rather odd beauty about it. It was a lonely and silent place. We could hear coyotes barking in the distant hills, which, though in contrast to the immense tranquility of the region, they seemed only to add to the great silence by providing a contrast to it. During many of those nights I had a feeling I did not dare describe to my buddies, a feeling that we were not alone. That we were being observed. Though by watchers who protected us. One night I again saw what I now know to be an observation of discs in the sky, and thereafter I saw more of them, both during the days and nights. The results of past experience restrained my exuberance, and impatience to point out the discs to my buddies. Whether or not they saw them I do not know. If they did, no doubt they mistook them for our own high-flying aircraft. One night a couple of my buddies insisted that I go with them into the nearby town of Juarez. Though I did not appreciate the loud, garish entertainment offered by such towns, I agreed, hoping it would break the monotony of camp life. When we got into town I had no difficulty breaking away from my friends, for they knew I was not interested in the kind of entertainment it offered us. I wandered off by myself to look for some souvenirs to send home. As I walked down a street toward a curio shop I had spotted, a taxi pulled over to the curb and the driver addressed me in Spanish. I replied in perhaps the worst Spanish on earth that I did not speak the language and his look showed me he hastily agreed. Then he said something else and pointed at a man in the back seat. I am afraid the novelty of the occasion quite nonplussed me. Much to my later chagrin I remember the first thing that struck my mind were some of the stories related in the bull sessions back at camp. The man had long blonde hair which hung over his shoulders. His skin appeared suntanned. The first quick observation showed that he was taller and heavier than the average Mexican. He spoke to me in English quite pleasantly, though I remember he had a slight Mexican accent. I have something to tell you. Would you get in the cab? He asked, but I demurred, making the excuse I had to find my buddies and go back to camp semicolon and at the same time I walked on. As I turned he smiled and merely said, "All right," again quite pleasantly. When I told the others about it, there were many guffaws, and for several days I was the butt of much good-natured ribbing. But upon reflection I wondered if I could have made a mistake. I remembered the discs, and again many of the things the girl had told me. Could this have been some of our people who she had promised would seek me out? They will always be around. Watching out for you. Guiding you. But I never saw the man again. Maneuvers moved us from place to place and finally we arrived at Camp Cook, in California, where a lot of scuttlebutt had it we were being readied for shipping out. I wangled a leave of absence and went to Abilene, Texas, to see my firstborn, my son, Robert. My wife and baby were staying there with relatives, and we had a happy reunion. A few days after I returned, another happening in the chain of events, which would finally change my life completely, occurred. As I was walking on the campgrounds I heard someone call my name. I looked around, but saw no one familiar. I thought I must be mistaken. As I continued walking, a man in khaki uniform approached me from the opposite direction, and I again heard my name called out. It seemed to be coming from his direction, though I could not figure why because I did not know the man. He was of average height, and apparently muscular and well built. All the while I was puzzling over what he wanted with me and the peculiarity of the voice, not so much the voice as of my confusion about where it was coming from. It seemed to be coming from his direction, yet it was not audible. Later I was to learn the sound was not audible but a projected mental sound which I only thought I heard. A stab of memory quickened my mental processes as I realized this was telepathic communication, for I had heard the sounds not with my ears but with my mind. I stopped in my tracks. Was this the kind of man the girl had spoken of, someone from another planet? This sudden realization that such a thing was possible stunned me for a moment, and for a brief second or two I was even afraid, though it was an occasion I had long hoped for and longingly expected. Then he greeted me, speaking audibly, pronouncing my name and extending his hand. I stood thus staring at him with, I am embarrassingly afraid, a very blank look on my face. Slowly I raised my hand and took his. I suspect the first spaceman I met did not gain an impression that Earth people had firm hand clasps, because mine was very weak. Then he smiled, put a gentle pressure on my hand, and I suddenly felt warmth glowingly permeate my entire body. Then I returned the handshake, grasping the hand clasp with my other hand as I again realized some of the same feelings I had experienced long ago on the rock in the woods. As that scene came flashing across my mind again in what seemed a whirl of stimuli, he picked up my thoughts. Yes, Howard, I know of the contact you had with one of our people when you were very young, and you will see her again in the future. I looked up with what must have been an obvious appearance of joy and Metha's eyes. He smiled knowingly. He was a fine-looking man. Although there was something definitely unusual about him, he could have passed, and did, for an ordinary GI. The singularity of the man probably was not because of the finely chiseled features and the luminous, almost liquid quality of his eyes, but in the communication I felt. I could sense that the man was kind, wise, emotionally and spiritually developed beyond anyone I had ever met. Although a kind of reserve he wore as if a part of him set him apart from an ordinary person, I somehow accepted with no surprise the emergence of an underplayed, yet natural sense of humor. I know about your Juarez contact, he said, and it was confirmed that the man in the taxi had been one of the space people. He chuckled. We told him he should cut his hair. I have, you know. It's difficult even for us to keep up with you folk and learn just how you think. I apologized for goofing up the contact, but he waved away my remonstration. He realized that army regulations encouraged caution in such areas, and that Juarez was not the best place in the world for an interplanetary meeting. Then I stood open-mouthed in amazement as he related, in a matter-of-fact manner, things I had never dreamed could happen. Many Mexican people knew about what I term flying saucers and had been contacting the occupants of the craft. Long before the time of the conquistadors, he added, we made contact with the Aztecs. We helped these people in many ways, and it is too bad the conquerors came in war instead of goodwill and friendship, for there were many things the Aztecs could have taught them. Instead they withheld these secrets, and these perished with the civilization. Some of the secrets had to do with the use of sound and light to produce power and run machinery, though my new friends didn't elucidate. He remarked that gold discs which were sent back to the Queen of Spain contained such secrets, but the Spaniards were interested only in melting down the gold. I gathered from his conversation that the discs were some sort of sonic instruments used for levitations when turned to the frequencies of individuals using them. Other civilizations received the use of marvelous instruments, and these were used for peaceful purposes. But as in the case of the Aztecs, the secrets were destroyed or forgotten when warlike races invaded. Thus it happens, over and over again, Howard. You'd think we'd give up. We won't. The man in Juarez was a visitor from a planet, he did not say what planet, who came to contact remnants of his own people still living on Earth, descendants of an ancient race which originally came here from his own planet. The surprises kept coming. He suddenly told me that my outfit would be leaving for Hawaii soon, and that I would be put on detached service with special duties which would give me more free time for certain tasks I was to perform. He said I would have a contact in Hawaii and would be given further instructions. Another person in our camp had also been contacted, he said. I asked him who, An army officer, he replied, without giving the name. Sensing my curiosity, he added. It makes no matter, you and he will not meet. A few weeks later we shipped out to Hawaii. 3. Hawaii contact the G. I's predictions proved remarkably accurate.